diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Have never been worse, as we all know. Nowhere is it more evident than in this report released today, explosive and scandalous mismanagement of BC housing.
Frankly, a report that nobody would have known about if it hadn't been leaked by a whistleblower. Why should anyone believe that he wasn't aware of the gross mismanagement at BC Happening that was happening right under his nose?
What is the solution to homelessness? The obvious answer is homes. But the reality is much more complicated, and people have been dedicating themselves to finding real solutions for a long time. In British Columbia, two people have been particularly committed to this cause. One was the head of a women's nonprofit, and the other, the CEO of a provincial housing agency. They were united by shared passions for helping the disadvantaged. And then they fell in love. But somehow it all took a very wrong turn, leading to scandal, brown envelopes dropped on reporters' doorsteps, leaked text messages, a defiant chairperson refusing to step down, and accusations that housing mismanagement may have caused a tragic fire. All of that leading to the debate that you just heard from the BC legislature. Today, Cherie Suturin brings you a story from BC, where two well-intentioned housing CEOs were found to have broken the rules with disastrous consequences. Wait for it.
A few months ago, a scandal broke out in British Columbia. The CEO of a Crown corporation was found to be giving preferential treatment to his wife's housing nonprofit. From the outside, it seemed kind of juicy, but not a huge deal in the grand scheme of government-related f**ks. No one was profiting from all of this. And when it comes to social housing, a nonprofit being given more projects, well, that's not usually a bad thing. But then I got a message from my former colleague out in Vancouver, reporter Jen St. Denis. She said that there was so much more to the story than people were hearing in the news. She said that reporters in BC had actually been trying to highlight the problems between Atira and BC Housing for almost 10 years, and that she had been targeted for trying to draw attention to these issues. And she said that in the decades since reporters first pointed out the problem, she had found that conditions in Atira Housing had deteriorated, and there were allegations that mismanagement may have led to a deadly fire. All while it became the largest and most well-funded housing nonprofit in the province. She said that no one had yet connected the dots from the past to the present to give the full story of a decade of mismanagement in secrecy. So that's exactly what we're going to do.
I am Jen St. Denis. I am a reporter at the TAI.
Jen, can you describe some of what your work has been at the TAI?
So I was hired at the TAI in the summer of 2020 to report exclusively on the Downtown East Side neighborhood. And the Downtown East Side is a neighborhood in Vancouver. It's the lowest income neighborhood in Vancouver. It's a place where residents are struggling with a lot of different problems, with extreme levels of poverty. Many people are struggling with addiction and drug use, and also a lot of people struggling with health conditions. So it's a neighborhood that can be very close-knit and where people help each other out a lot, but also where people are struggling with some pretty serious problems.
The Downtown East Side has a lot of one type of housing called single-room occupancy, or SROs. SROs used to be old hotels, built around the turn of the century for travelers and temporary workers. The rooms are small and share communal bathrooms. but in modern times, they became a source of housing for low-income people. Back in 2007, the world was about to shine a spotlight on Vancouver.
The 21st Olympic Winter Games in 2010 are awarded to the city of Vancouver.
With the world's media coming to town, the pressure was on to project a bright, shiny image. People living on the street in the downtown east side weren't supposed to be part of that image. So the province bought up a lot of the old hotel stock in an attempt to get the homeless off the streets. BC Housing was the Crown Corporation in charge of developing and administrating this housing. And they brought on several nonprofit organizations to help manage them. One of those nonprofits was Atira Women's Resource Society. They operated transitional housing for women fleeing from domestic violence. And under the leadership of then-CEO Janice Abbott, they began to get into managing social housing. They had a for-profit arm called Atira Property Management Incorporated, which distributed their profits back to the charity. APMI took on management of 13 SROs.
Can you tell me about Janice Abbott? Have you met her?
I've interviewed her a lot over the years. She's always been a really forthright, plain-spoken person who was really good at talking to media about these really hard issues like homelessness and how hard it is to find housing for people. She was a great source over the years to talk about those issues. And she would often, you know, have this very, clearly had a huge passion for these issues and at times had a lot of anger at the system, at, you know, the government maybe that not helping enough or just the systems that kept people in poverty.
Janice Abbott was forthright about the issues facing the people she served through Atira. In one interview, she said that she would rather hire people with lived experience than a university degree because of their ability to relate to the people they served.
But I decided almost as soon as I started working there that we would focus on women who had lived experience. Mostly because women with lived experience have the ability to empathize. They've been in that place. They've walked in that place before.
Janice applied that same thinking to running the SROs for low-income people. She was also involved in city initiatives to address homelessness. Reporter Frances Bueller was on the housing beat at the time, and she says that's where Janice and her future husband got to know each other, on a committee put together by then-Mayor Gregor Robertson.
I mean, they obviously knew each other because he was the head of BC Housing and she was running, you know, one of the services, but they were in these meetings, you know, nonstop together. As Gregor Robertson was saying, he was going to, you know, eliminate homelessness. And he had this task force of about, I don't know, a dozen people who were meeting pretty intensively.
So who is Shane Ramsey, the former head of BC Housing?
So Shane has been in the BC Housing sector for years and years and years. He was involved in BC Housing as an executive for a number of years in the 90s, and then in 2000 he became CEO of BC Housing. And he was CEO for a really long time, for 22 years, so from 2000 to the summer of 2022. Shane is really known as someone who was able to kind of get housing built in environments where, you know, that might have been difficult. He was able to work with whoever was in power, like whichever government in power, Shane was able to form relationships with them. So he's someone who was really able to kind of work his connections, which is very common in the housing sector. It's a sector where people are, you know, they're making deals, they're trying to get things done. And again, just like Janice, fueled by passion for housing people.
By 2010, they were married. And concerns about their relationship being a potential conflict of interest were brushed aside.
You know, back in those early days, there were always concerns about how it looked. You know, it just didn't look good. And this man who used to be a columnist for the Vancouver Courier, Alan Garr, like he wrote a column in 2011 or 2012 saying, this just doesn't smell good. Like they should do something about it. And I think the problem was people wanted Shane to be at BC Housing because he's a very creative, skillful, talented, you know, like housing developer. And I think there was a certain feminist opinion that, like, well, why should Janice have to quit? Like, why does the wife have to quit? You know, why doesn't he quit?
So this story kind of sounds a lot like two do-gooders who wanted to end homelessness, falling in love over their shared passion. And even if there was a potential conflict of interest, it's kind of hard to hate on this relationship. Under Janice's leadership, Atiga was taking on many SROs with the aim of getting homeless people housed. And Chain was this guy who could get along with anyone in his mission to build up housing stock for low-income folks. But then came a CBC investigation in 2012. It was the first to take a close look at the situation. Reporters Kathy Tomlinson and Eric Rankin revealed concerning conditions at Atiga-operated SROs. Workers at the hotels referred to them as crack shacks and brothels.
It appears the Housing Society became squeezed between underfunding from the province and overzealousness by the city to get the homeless off the streets. Eric Rankin has been looking at the perfect storm that swamped Atiga.
The province is purchasing 10 single-room occupancy hotels in Vancouver.
It began with such promise 5 years ago, the province announcing it was buying up troubled downtown Eastside hotels, taking over more every year, and turning the management of 13 over to Atiga.
Kathy and Eric's reporting really brought that to the public's attention more, because Kathy was talking to all of these employees and residents of these SROs who were bringing up these concerns about... Workers were talking about safety concerns. They were talking about how many of their colleagues that they were working with were using drugs on the job, and to the point that they were not able to really help them in their work. The residents were complaining that the buildings were really dirty, overrun with pests, and that they were dangerous, that there was a lot of organized crime, drug dealing activity in the building that was leading to violence. And at the time, Janice Abbott strongly said that, you know, these buildings really need to be renovated. We need government money to do that.
Janice Abbott responded to the problems cited in the CBC report, saying there was no money to make improvements to housing. She called out the province for lack of funding. The CBC report was also one of the first to mention the conflict of interest between Atiga's CEO and BC Housing CEO.
Kathy, in her reporting, really emphasized this conflict of interest and was really questioning, you know, is this okay? And she and Eric went to Rich Coleman, who was the housing minister at the time, to ask him if he was okay with this. And Rich Coleman was really, you know, strongly supportive of them. He said, you know, I trust Shane and Janice. They came to me right away when they started dating, and I knew about this. And there is a conflict of interest screen in place, a special document that lays out the rules of how they're supposed to conduct themselves.
But despite the assurances of the housing minister, there were still concerns about this relationship. Like in 2014, when the Vancouver Sun reported that Atiga had to be bailed out by BC Housing for amassing over $800,000 in deficits. Janice told the Sun that she had hesitated going to BC Housing to get the necessary funding, specifically because of the optics surrounding the potential conflict of interest. 10 years after those first stories were published, Jen St. Dennis was reporting on the downtown east side for the Tyee, and she found the conditions of the Atiga-run SROs had not changed. In fact, they may have gotten worse.
We found a few things that are a little bit unusual compared to how other nonprofit housing providers run their buildings, their SROs. So the first thing was the sheer number. Now they run 18 SROs, and that compares to a number more like between 4 and 8 SROs is more like what other nonprofits run. They were also doing this with a workforce that was often being hired directly from the downtown Eastside community. And those workers were being paid much less than other workers at other supportive housing buildings, including SROs. So there was this really stark differential in the rate of pay that people were being paid. It was like $10 less than you'd make at another SRO. We also found that, you know, it's a great idea to hire from the community and provide employment, but a lot of the workers lived in other APMI-operated SROs. So they were essentially, their landlord and their employer were the same. And so that was also seemed to create some problems. And then the other thing we started hearing about was just that there was just a really complete lack of training. We heard from some workers that they had actually done their own naloxone training, and naloxone is a drug that is used to reverse overdoses. Overdoses happen a lot in the SROs. Most workers are having to deal with them. And so I heard from one worker, for instance, that she had to go on YouTube to like watch a YouTube video about how to administer naloxone because she didn't get that training before she started her first shift.
Right. And it seems like, especially that environment, that's something that you would really need.
It's something you would really need. Yes. Yeah. And another thing, and I think this is actually common to a lot of housing providers, well, we heard a lot of complaints about single staffing. So people would be the sole person on duty. And that at times was extremely dangerous. There was one incident at the Gastown Hotel where somebody was stabbed. A couple people were stabbed. One person died. And the one person on staff that night had to, you know, call the ambulance, but also was like trying to fend off the person who was attacking the other people. Like, just, you just hear about situations where you think, wow, that's really dangerous. And another person on duty probably would have really helped in that situation.
What's it like to live in one of these buildings? Like, what's life like there?
It can be a little chaotic. These buildings, you know, often have really, really narrow hallways. People are often doing drugs in the middle of the hallway. Sometimes it can be really noisy at times. But people also often have like really strong connections with their neighbors. So they're often, you know, they know who everybody is who lives in their building. They kind of know what's going on with them. So these buildings, they can be very chaotic places, and there can be a lot of violence happening within the buildings because they are kind of inextricably linked to the illicit drug market. But at the same time, often some of the tenants have lived there for years and years and years and know their neighbors really well.
And in terms of building maintenance, like, how is that being maintained?
It's always a challenge in the SROs because, first of all, they're old. They have old plumbing systems. And then you might have people living in them who are either, because of whatever reason, they might be just violent, or they might be having severe mental health episodes and they might be damaging the building. And that's very common. So there's a bunch of different, you know, challenges that are going on with maintaining the SROs. It is very, very challenging because there is constant maintenance that has to be done.
In the years since Atira had signed their first contract, the number of SROs they had taken on had grown, and by 2020 they were running 18 SROs and looking at more. But many had raised concerns about the conditions of the housing and that workers' wages seemed lower compared to similar jobs. Ultimately, Jen's reporting caught the attention of Atira, and not in a good way. In 2021, she had just completed some reporting on dangerous working conditions in Atira buildings. When someone alerted her, she was not welcome in those buildings anymore.
I heard from my sources that my picture had been posted in all of the Atira buildings. And so it's a picture of my headshot, and it says Atira wide ban. And it talks about how I have been going into these buildings and talking to tenants and how this is a problem. And I've been representing myself as an advocate. I just want to emphasize, I've always represented myself as a journalist. They wrote a very, very long kind of rebuttal to my reporting at some point, too, where they kind of accused me of being classist and racist and transphobic and really everything under the sun. I kind of implied that I had been violating people's privacy by coming into the buildings and walking around and talking to people. I just want to emphasize that it's extremely important for us to be able to get inside the buildings when we're hearing about complaints, because people who live in poverty and might have problems with addiction or mental health are often not believed. So that evidence, taking photos, is really important.
In early 2022, Atira posted an extensive statement on their website. They said Jen's reporting was, quote, causing harm. They said her stories were, quote, a thinly veiled attempt to expose Janice Abbott. And they said that it was clinging onto gossip that she was corrupt. There were accusations of Jen's reporting being racist, classist, and sexist. Atira also responded to allegations of the underpaid staff. They said they paid front desk workers between $17 and $19 per hour and gave them generous benefits. But on the same day Atira posted their response to Jen's reporting, another story concerning Atira broke in the Globe and Mail. Frances Bueller reported that there was an audit done of Atira 4 years previously. The report had never been made public. It was leaked to Bueller in a brown envelope.
It was one of those things where it really was a brown envelope left on my doorstep. I was kind of thrilled because, you know, like, it doesn't often really arrive that way. Although I, along with others, including mostly Jen St. Denis, had been hearing for years, really, about people who had concerns that it just wasn't operating like a normal organization where you knew what the rules were and, you know, who was in charge of what and who really, you know, there was the sense that there were secret pathways.
According to the audit, Atira was late with financial reporting. They were running deficits. There was overall poor financial management. Then several BC Housing staffers began talking to reporters like Jen.
But what these staffers started telling me was that Shane repeatedly broke the conflict of interest rules. And these were multiple staffers. I think I talked to about three or four people initially, and they were all telling me the same thing, and it was just that it was repeated. This 2018 financial review that they had commissioned was actually an attempt to kind of bring to light some of these problems. I talked to a former BC Housing staffer who tried to raise these concerns in 2010 or 2011, which is really far back. You know, he would be called into a meeting with Shane Ramsey where Shane would discuss something to do with the TIRA, and he would say things like, this meeting never happened. And that man, that executive, he went to the board, and that's what he was supposed to do. He went to the board chair and complained about it. Well, then, you know, his workplace became a bit harder and he ended up quitting. He was kind of felt that he had been pushed out. That happened to staffer after staffer that I talked to, that people who raised concerns about this were either fired or pushed out of the organization. And so that happened from 2010 right up until, you know, the 2018 to kind of 2020 period, that people were kind of had this climate of fear that if they spoke out against this, that there would be a punishment.
The problems with ATIRA and BC Housing were building. And by this time, ATIRA had become the largest manager of social housing in the province, collecting $35 million more than the next highest funded housing nonprofit. It was also the one that received the most complaints. Then one day, an ATIRA-operated SRO called the Winters Hotel caught on fire.
I was yelling, fire, fire, people get out, we're not going to put this out.
We heard fire, and then I looked out and I seen fire coming out of the window. I overheard people screaming that there was no fire extinguishers, and the fire extinguishers that were there were empty.
And then from that point, I knew we weren't going to put it out because there was no fire extinguisher, no water, we had nothing around.
On April 11th, 2022, the Winters Hotel burned to the ground. Just a few days prior, there had been another small fire in the building, which prompted fire services being called. But in the process of putting out the flame, the sprinkler system and fire alarms were disabled, and fire extinguishers were used up. They were not turned back on. 3 days later, tragedy struck. Many former residents of the hotel have recounted to Jen the alarming series of events that led to the tragedy.
And so this is something I first heard from tenants who tried to fight the fire, that they ran around the building looking for a fire extinguisher to put out the fire. But they kept on finding that the fire extinguishers were empty. So if you can imagine, you know, you see a fire, and it was relatively small, they said, at the time that they found it in this room. If you can imagine running to one end, grabbing a fire extinguisher, trying to use it, and it being empty, running to the other end, grabbing a fire extinguisher, finding it empty as well, finally grabbing a mop bucket, trying to use that. People were running out to go across the street to another SRO called the Dominion to see if they could get fire extinguishers there. So it was a frantic effort to get the fire under control, but just there was just no tools. And then the fire itself getting out of control, the stories that people told were just absolutely horrific. People told stories of they were crawling on the floor because they were trying to get under the smoke, and they had blisters on their arm because the floor was so hot. People talked about walking through walls of flame to get out. And people talked about, a lot of people woke up. They were sleeping at the time of the fire. It happened around 10 or 11 in the morning. They talk about waking up into just thick black smoke and being totally disoriented. And some people were able to get their animals out, but a lot of people lost pets in the fire, and they're still heartbroken about that.
You mentioned, like, the sprinklers off, the alarms off, extinguishers gone. Whose responsibility was it to make sure those things were back and running?
It was the responsibility of ATIRA property management staff.
The Winters Hotel fire claimed the lives of two tenants. Marianne Garlow was 68 and a residential school survivor known for her devotion to her son. And Dennis Guy was 53, a passionate musician despite having hearing loss from a young age. According to Jen, the building was also supposed to be on a fire watch, which is an order from the fire department to have someone patrol every so often on the lookout for fires. ATIRA maintains they did put the Winters Hotel on a fire watch. But Jen has heard otherwise from several people who were on the ground that day.
So the fire department says that they investigated and that the fire watch was being done. However, I talked to 13 tenants and 4 business owners who say that they did not see regular patrols. They were not informed that the building was on fire watch, and they did not see any notices posted, which you're all supposed to do if there's a fire watch. And I also have reported that the front desk clerk who was working on April 11th, the day that the fire started, did not know that the fire alarm was off.
In the months that followed the fire, the real story about what had been happening behind the scenes at BC Housing began to unfold. A report commissioned by the province said there were problems with BC Housing's financial decision-making, that it was handing out multi-million dollar contracts with no formal criteria, and that the CEO would sometimes award contracts unilaterally. Days later, the BC government sends out a press release announcing the entire board of BC Housing had been fired. Then just a few months after that, old text messages from Shane to an employee surfaced. Shane appears to suggest Adira should take on several more projects. Finally, in March 2023, third-party firm Ernst & Young released a second report digging into the relationship between Adira and BC Housing. The report said that Ramsey, quote, repeatedly involved himself in matters related to Adira through other BC Housing employees. It also said that Adira used $2 million in restricted funds that were to go back to BC Housing to help purchase another SRO building. The report also said that Adira asked for BC Housing money to buy a new property, but the property value was overestimated. And in one instance, meeting minutes were edited to change an executive's concerns around a potential Adira project. That was quickly followed by reports on the existence of a second Ernst & Young report, which had not yet been released to the public. And just a month later, Shane Ramsey stepped down from his position. So almost a decade after the first concerns were reported about BC Housing and Adira, 5 years after the secret report and Atira's finances were completed, and over a year after the winter's fire, this conflict of interest was finally being investigated.
Yeah, so the investigation report found that indeed Shane Ramsey had been breaking the conflict of interest rules repeatedly for years, since 2010, since they had gotten married. And it also found that this led to basically BC Housing being unable to kind of really have proper financial oversight over these spending decisions. And it highlighted just how much more money Adira has gotten over the years recently compared to other nonprofit housing providers. You know, Adira has gotten $35 million more in 2022 than its next highest funded housing provider. It also found that Shane Ramsey and this other BC Housing executive, Abbas Faridawala, had deleted texts, and they were not supposed to be doing that. They'd been told to keep all records, but they had deleted texts. And in addition, it found evidence that, you know, Shane was well aware that he was breaking the rules, that he would make comments like, you know, if anybody asks, say this is your idea.
The report also found that Adira had asked for BC Housing money to buy new properties, but the value of those properties would often be overestimated. Other times, the building's assessed maintenance costs would be undervalued, or minutes changed to make it seem costs were lower than they were.
For one of those property transactions, it's a building called 303 Columbia, Shane Ramsey actually pressured a BC Housing executive to change his vote whether or not to help Adira buy the property, and then changed meeting minutes to kind of soften this executive's criticism of the project and of the deal. So those are some of the things that the investigation found. It was pretty, you know, it was pretty eye-opening. It was actually pretty shocking, the level of activity that had been happening.
The BC government was in an uproar. During question period on the day the report was released, Premier David Eby was met with harsh criticism.
Housing and homelessness have never been worse, as we all know. Nowhere is it more evident than in this report released today, explosive and scandalous mismanagement of BC Housing.
Frankly, a report that nobody would have known about if it hadn't been leaked by a whistleblower. Why should anyone believe that he wasn't aware of the gross mismanagement at BC Happening that was happening right under his nose?
I would remind the Premier that at the Winters Hotel, there was a fatal fire that killed two people and displaced hundreds of others. And that BDO report that this Premier...